post loudness.
Audio on the French.
You're able to just plan differently, plan quicker, and, you know, when they say, you know, money on the wood make the game go good.
Greetings, artists, creators, and innovators. You are now listening to the High Water Podcast, practical pop culture driven advice for the everyday artist and creative. I am your host, Chaka Reeves, and I am super excited to have cultural curator, arts advocate, artist, alchemist, and black girl magician, Janice Bond. Hey, Jay.
Hey.
How are you?
Great. I loved those last few times. That was great.
It just came out of my spirit. One of the things that anybody that knows Janice Bond will say is Janice Bond definitely makes things happen. We're going to be talking with her today about her career, not only as a curator of great exhibitions such as Abandoned Margins, but also her career as a multimedia and photo-based artist. She just recently came back from Latvia, where she had a exhibition of her really, really powerful piece, Beyond the Binary, which focuses on figurative representations of femininity. One of the things that was really interesting to talk with about Janice about her recent trip is she displayed this work, which primarily features black women in a place where there were no black people. Like, you didn't even see like a Nigerian or anything there, and they're everywhere. So shout out to Nigerians. I'm still waiting for my Naja application to go through. But anyways, so tell me about what your career has looked like in the past few months.
Well, the past couple of months, let's start with January. So January was really awesome. There was the opening reception for Abandoned Margins, Policing the Black Female Body at Woman Made Gallery, as well as the opening reception for my solo exhibition, Beyond the Binary. It was a double hitter. It was really great. Abandoned Margins, Policing the Black Female Body had artists such as Lee Bullitt, Nick Kay, Shoshana Weinberger, Candace Hunter, Nakia Brown, many, many others. All of them were really, really great, insightful. And there was also a symposium that was truly phenomenal, curated by artist and arts administrator Tracy Hall here in Chicago, that had everyone from Krista Franklin and many, many other artists and intellectuals and community organizers there to participate and lend their ear. Then right before that was the opening reception for Gateway, which was a show I curated over at Joby Arts Center, 33 Contemporary Gallery, that's owned and directed by Sergio Gomez. And that featured artists like Marcus Leslie from Brooklyn, Von Spann from Jersey, Lucy Slavinsky, Liz Murray. I had music boxes from Sadie Woods, Jerome. Rob Welch, so many great artists, Sonia Henderson, Natasha Cole. And then in February, launched with Zakia Najiba, Gallery 1506, which is an art space or exhibition space within the Silver Room in Hyde Park. And so we had the inaugural exhibition there of The Greatest. And that was in tribute, obviously, to the greatest, Muhammad Ali. And also individuals and people both in communities locally, hyperlocally, and abroad, intergenerational, that have influenced the greatness of various cultures throughout time. And so we had artists such as Brian Golden, Shelby Stone, Arthur Wright, who's currently a artist in residence over at Rebuilt Foundation, and several others. And so besides that, I mean, just more and more work. Just came back from the Mark Rothko Art Center for the Iron International Photography Symposium, where I showed an excerpt of Beyond the Binary. This time, self-portraits were a part of that, which hadn't been done before. And I also gave a lecture and a couple of things there. And so this has been a busy year so far, but all good things, you know, in this industry, when you're busy, there's business.
And that is some serious business. Can you talk a little bit about balancing not just being a creator of art, but being a curator, and also the fact that you have your own consultancy business? So you're not just doing gigs here and there, but you are set up to like actually have companies as clients.
Well, you know, I've always considered myself a creative, but just in the past 2 years, I've allowed myself to really embrace the word artist as one of my titles. I mean, it wasn't something that I rushed to. It was just something that I always knew, and it was always there. I was always making and creating. And as they say, it's not what they call you, it's what you answer to, right? So I knew my formal education background is in business and marketing with a focus in communication design. And so any work that I've done in arts and culture, whether it was a consultant or otherwise, really was rooted in that perspective, even if it was influenced from things that were more emotional or visual, whatever have you. So having a consultancy was really a part of recognizing the necessity of more people like myself. And you could connect that to whether I mean age, culture, ethnicity, gender, whatever you want to attribute it to. I probably connected it that way too. But I wanted to see more of me in spaces and places that were at the table, not just as a contributor, which obviously those contributions are great, but in a space where people were having the conversations of how and where spend was controlled and how these things come to be and how these budgets came about and how these collaborations are able to work well and who was making those decisions. And those are things that I wanted to know. And I knew that part of knowing it was working within it. And so I decided to structure my consultancy in that way. And so right now, you know, in addition to developing or managing arts programming or coordination, creative mediation, communications related to the creative arts, we're also taking on the curatorial practice as a business. And so you'll start to see more and more. For example, right now, there's an exhibition up at Mott Street Restaurant of two local artists, local global artists, David Anthony Geary and Liz Murray, Line of Sight, a show that I curated there. They are clients. They're clients. They're a restaurant, and they are looking for work to enhance their business and make their clientele base feel great and feel inspired when they come in. It's just as important as the food that they're serving. And so you'll start to see more of my curatorial practice both be extremely in the vein of my personal curatorial practice and interests or my own artwork, but then there'll also be more work in restaurants and hotels and other places that I'm lending my creativity and my network of artists and artisans to enhance their spaces and put more, if we want to speak hyperlocally, more Chicago art in Chicago spaces, mm-hmm. period. More mm-hmm. Chicago art in Chicago spaces over and over and over again. And filling up as many great walls with great art and great people as we possibly can, and then duplicating that in other markets. And so balancing that, the thing is that I remember that I had to figure out how to start to consolidate some of my dreams because I can't be everywhere all the time, and I don't want to be. And also, I don't really have the interest in completely carrying out everything that's in my head. Really, sometimes I'm more interested in just seeing it happen, and it would be great if someone else did it because it's probably their dream. Like, I love, even as we're here right now, like, I love podcasts. I love radio. I love studios and different things like that. It's not my life dream to own one, but if I had a fund or an institution or a mechanism by which that I could fund and support podcasts or things like that, different forms of media and storytelling that was run by networks of people that I support, then sure, have this check, you know. And I think that people, we need to look as artists and arts administrators and arts entrepreneurs, realize that that's where we are in history. Like, we need to collect art amongst each other. We need to collect and share music and information amongst each other. And we also need to start putting in our business model the capacity to fiscally support each other, because that is how things are going to move. So in my business model, in my budget, when I look at how I want to generate income for myself, I already have in my budget, okay, in my dream budget, I want to be able to put this amount of money aside to buy art. I want to put this amount of money aside to possibly be able to be an angel investor, or, you know, donate money to different institutions or organizations or businesses within my community or within my creative community that I support. Because we can't wait for grants to come along. We can't wait for funders to come along. And where we need to be is ultimately self-funded, whatever that self looks like. And to round that idea out a little bit, it makes me think about the $17 million that Denzel Washington raised for the Smithsonian. And for me, it's bittersweet, and it's more sweet bitter, because it's really awesome, and I'm glad that it happened. I'm so glad that it happened, mm-hmm. and I wish that it could happen 10 more times, and I hope it does. At the same time, I look at museums like Charles Wright and even our own DuSable and many other Black museums and institutions that have been here for decades that are struggling and can't get $50,000 out of their own community at a given time without a struggle. But in one night, a celebrity can raise, you know, $17 million. We need to be aware that this institution is wonderful. It is great, but it should not be the catch-all for funding for Black arts institutions in this country. And people need to, in addition to supporting this institution, look hyperlocally to the small museum or the organization or whatever have you that may have a budget that's less than maybe even $300,000 or $200,000 or $100,000, but has been the root of arts and culture or the keepers of culture in their communities, and they need their support as well. Mm-hmm. Project Row House, I'm originally from Houston, Texas, you know that. Mm-hmm. Project Row House was my introduction to public art, community and social engagement. I didn't know what any of those words meant, but I remember going there when I was in elementary school, and I remember seeing those developments and programs when I was in elementary school, and growing up with that, even again, not knowing academically what any of these terms were, or where they were going, what Rick had in mind, not understanding the intersections. And here we are, what, 30 plus years later, with Project Row House making intersections and influencing all over the world. What if people did not continue to invest in that space and it just disappeared? And those row houses in that area of Houston just became another area of gentrified houses or spaces, like other parts of the museum district or Third Ward, mm-hmm. or like the places that are struggling right now in Houston, like Freedmanstown is struggling, really, really struggling. And their organization in the space that I'm looking to help right now, because developers want to basically dig up these roads that were hand laid by the first freed Blacks that came to Houston, and they built homes and streets. And what a lot of people did, you know, in the South, and, you know, my family's from the South, I said that already, but in other parts of the South, like Louisiana, what you would do is you would just build all your family homes on one street. You know, your aunt would live here, your grandma would live here, you would live here. And so your community wasn't just your community. It was literally your blood family living in these one space. And so a lot of those homes have come down, but there are a few left that the institution was able to preserve. And then there are these hand-laid streets. And so, like, there's just one, I believe there's one intersection left. And so they're fighting right now with the mayor, hoping to get the new mayor's approval to keep those streets. And really, at the end of the day, it's about funding. And so I say all that to say, you know, again, going back to the balance of work and life, and or the balance of being an artist and arts administrator and curator, It's that I know as a person in business and a person that was educated in business that I had to have more than one, two, three streams of income, especially if I wanted to be in a position of wealth that would allow me to support creatively the communities that I intend to serve, both hyperlocally and otherwise.
Money is energy.
Yeah.
Money, so energy can't be destroyed. It can only be transferred. So when you're talking about not only putting yourself in a situation as an artist or a curator of art, but thinking in a business mind frame where I'm not just going to attract energy that'll attract attention to my art or the art of people who I really believe in, but building into your business model, having a fund that would support art that's in a particular vein or a particular topic. One of the things that a lot of people that work in nonprofit spaces get frustrated about is there isn't this sense of art itself as being part of the common good, being part of civic good. So you're not just applying for oftentimes grants to fund art, you're funding art basically that is around a particular topic that someone with money decided was important. So I think that that's something that we should really definitely think about, not just, you know, becoming kind of conduits for this money energy for work that we like and artists that we like, but the money game now, at least from my side of it, seems to be, you know, you're not just going to give money to youth because you should have access to programs. You're going to give money for youth doing civic engagement because this organization decided that civic engagement is important, or this organization decided that journalism is important. So they'll fund our program as long as we're doing news. But it's not just about the fact that young people need this outlet.
Well, you said that money is energy, and I agree with that. I also believe that money is a time machine. Because any of the ideas that you and I have right now, or anyone has right now, if I were to give you $1 million.
Thank you.
Envelope. Here you go. Envelope.
you all can't see it, but yeah. She literally just gave me $1 million.
Bam. And if I gave you $1 million in an envelope and said, here you are, first day of the rest of your life, then what you would get up in the morning and do the next day as it pertained to your
after sitting on your lap?
How long? So after, you know, you finish that, and by that I mean getting up the next day and thinking about, you know, what next. I mean, you negotiate differently. You're able to just plan differently, plan quicker. And you know, when they say, you know, money on the wood make the game go good, and that's an old saying, but it's also a good point of negotiation. You know, it's a lot easier to be like, hey, I want to do this, and this, and this is what I have. And so when you're talking about organizations and funders and them having these spaces like, oh, civic engagement, so forth and so on, I think that it's really important for us to get present. I don't think it makes me a pessimist in any way. I think it's more about being a realist. I think if we were to start to look at a lot of funding or funders and say, okay, yes, they want to fund these specific things this specific way because their organization has stated to their stakeholders and to the general public, this is who we are, and this is the problem that we solve with our money. It's kind of that black and white, you know, and no pun intended, but obviously a lot of times it does become black and white, right? So I think that if there's going to be a place or a space where we want to say, because you do know there are tons of funds out there that you can't even apply to in arts and culture unless you're invited, you know. So there are plenty of funds. Trust me, there's money out there for artists that or arts institutions or art makers or whatever that is just for the sake of art, just for the sake for you to think. But you're not going to find that at a lot of the more popular funders or at the state level or so forth and so on, because they have, again, stakeholders, benchmarks, so forth and so on. They have their agendas or people with agendas or the people that are giving them money, agendas that they have to answer to. And again, that goes back to why ultimately it's going to be important to look at corporations, organizations. I mean, they look more and more like us every day. When I say whether it's millennial, when I say people of color, when I say that, you know, gender, all these different experiences that are coming into the corporate setting at a leadership level, going back to leadership, why leadership is so important in every industry, in every way, from Wall Street to the Wall of Respect. Like, all of leadership in all those areas is just, like, really important, because we need someone in Silicon Valley or at Google, any of these other companies or tech firms, or even in medicine, Medical Supply Co., whatever, any of these companies that are dumping money in all these crazy places, you know, and it's under the label of community engagement or civic engagement and programming or public engagement. All of these major corporations and institutions and organizations have these departments of education and, you know, all of this other stuff. Where is the leadership in a lot of those companies or organizations that's saying, hey, I know that we've been doing this XYZ for the past, you know, 5, 10, 20 years, right, but how about we start a fund that does XYZ or does this or does that? And that may not happen that year, but it may happen the year after or 2 years later. And does it really matter if it happens 2 years later, if you're talking about a fund that supports artists in the community where they've just built their new corporate headquarters for, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000 per artist for 20 artists or something like that for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to move the needle directly in the arts community and the arts entrepreneurship community hyperlocally. And so we need more people to just go straight to the source and just do it. So hopefully more organizations and funders will get to the point where they'll allow, find other methods of measurement besides just answering the stakeholders, and start to have more discretionary and experimental funds and allow artists to just do what it is that they do and not be a global name as yet. And understanding that everyone is no one and everyone until they're someone, right? You know, you're just you and I'm just me until I'm me over there or over here, right, or wherever, you know. And a lot of times that's just a matter of either A, finance or visibility, opportunity, or some combination of the two.
Right. Totally brought me back to one of my favorite quotes by one of my students. You remember which one I'm talking about?
Yes.
You remember which one I'm talking about? I remember I was asking one particular student basically why he felt he needed to have an extension on a particular project.
Can I answer?
And he didn't say this to me. He's not nuts. But, yes, Janice.
Because I'm me.
Yeah, so he, you know, Janice is trying to keep our clean rating on iTunes. But basically he said, B-I-T-C-H, I'm me. Now, I will say, he did not say this to me directly, you know, I mean, obviously not, because the kid's still alive, right?
Clearly.
But I just think about that when we are putting ourselves into a place as, you know, being creators. It really is just a matter of just us being us, who sees us being us, who decides that's important, and then who has the cachet to do something with that. In the vein of that, I think that one thing I'm really noticing, particularly with Black women in the art and pop culture space, like I don't know if it's like a chicken or egg thing, but as there is more of a consciousness about Black womanhood and femininity in pop culture, I wonder if it is then putting it on the radar of the stakeholders, the rainmakers, and you know, if I could, I would, you know, give Beyonce all the glory and the praise, but I mean, she's not the only one who's doing it. I'm just seeing kind of this upswelling of attention to women of color, particularly Black women, in the pop culture space. Now, as someone who is a Black woman and is really in tune to makers from all kinds of demographics, but particularly that demographic, do you feel like there is that symbiotic relationship where we see something more in pop culture, so there's something on the more fine art or like old money side that this decides that that's important, or does it work in that order, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my immediate thoughts are that we've been great for a long ass time.
Yes.
Since we came out the water, down the sun, and out our mamas. So I think that what's happened is that people at major institutions and at organizations or whatever have you, they have officially waved the wand, and we can go back to the wand later, but they waved the wand, and now it has been deemed profitable to invest in Black women, whether it's in positions of leadership, you know, at institutions, or integrating us more into advertising and marketing. Even if it is controversial, it's still good. And especially if you're talking about fashion, beauty, writing, art. I mean, if you don't have, if we're not there, then there's going to be the assumption, you know, if you're talking about pop culture, if we're not there, if you don't see at least one sister, you know, with a TWA or, you know, something, like if you don't see something, if that, if there is not that dust, you know, that, that gold dust coming in somewhere, then it's you're disconnected. And that's because even if we're nowhere, we're everywhere all the time, whether it be through our influence, whether it be through our art, whether it be through our love and humanity and just everything else. And even our trauma is everywhere and connects everywhere, even if it's not something that has been made a priority to resolve or care for or pay attention to. Even that, our suffering has been seen as or deemed as an art form, which I found to be particularly interesting. And so I've seen those trends too. I think that in addition to, again, the Black woman now being seen as profitable, I think it, in a different way this time, being in a position of leadership, I think that it's also a thing about, you know, just humanity coming full circle and reconciling itself with its own experiences and balancing. I mean, you can only tell yourself one side of a story so long before you end up going around the same card. You know, when are you going to see the other side of the card, the other side of the coin? You know, when the sentence is incomplete, even if there's a period at the end, you can feel when something is incomplete. And I feel that, again, going into this generation, we're in an interesting time where in an institution, you may find a representation of 3 to 4 generations working under the same roof. And I find that to be really interesting. You may have a boomer, you know, Gen X, Y, millennial, whatever, coming right in, working in the same institution, working in the same office. And what does that mean? You know, you have a generation now that's coming after millennials, that my daughter that has never known a world without social media or technology, rather.
Or a Black president.
Yeah, technology, or, you know, my youngest daughter, or without a Black president. My youngest daughter is too. So she's coming in on after everything. You know, I even look at prom photos now, and I remember when I was a debutante. Yeah, I was.
Me too.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's something that we share in common. Holly, white Absolutely. Gloves and waltz. You
Shout
know.
Out to the Lynx.
Yes. You know what I'm saying? Brentwood Baptist Church. Love y'all. So, yeah, I mean, I think about that white dress. I think about being Southern. Think about, you know, spending months upon months, you know, learning the waltz and the curtsy and all these, like, traditional things. And I remember, you know, the day of my cotillion, how my mom was like, yo, you know, and I had the big fro, you know, curls, all that, whatever. Mm. Mom was like, I don't know what your plans are for your hair today, but it's not going to be that. And it wasn't her trying to control me. It was just this idea of refinement, not looking. We were back to it. Refinement mm-hmm. didn't look like that. It didn't look like untamed curls and froze or whatever. But now, you know, you look at prom pictures and you look at, you know, the young girls that are graduating now, they're mm-hmm. wearing, you know, the full ball gowns. They're wearing the afros, you know, so forth and so on.
Kente prints and prom dresses, which I adore.
And they're doing all of it, and it's fabulous. And it's just a different generation. So within that, it's like, what does it look like when we have several different generations that have had several different experiences, both with the general public, hyperlocally to internationally, as well as when you're talking about boomers and, you know, others that are slightly older, what does it mean when you are working with generations that have seen themselves and had the world society see them differently, and them having a different level of access to different areas of their industry over the decades, and how that shifted. And then in addition to that, now having to deal with ageism, you know, after once their color is okay, and once their unique experience is okay, and everything else becomes okay. Well, by the time all of that became okay, many of them now are facing the now you're too old. You know, and getting pushed out of these institutions that they've helped build for less money than we're able to, as millennials come in and negotiate. Many, 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 many other things that could go down the line. And so that goes back into there's value being seen and there's investments being made. I still push to say that there needs to be investment intergenerationally as well as interculturally, because there's a knowledge transfer and an information transfer that can happen both ways if institutions and organizations aren't so quick to say, okay, now we just want to get some new blood in here. Mm-hmm. What happens sometimes when you get completely new blood in a place is that you may start to repeat some mistakes with new technology. You know, you may bring in some things that got pulled out a long time ago because you don't have that guidance from that person, that library that's been there for a long time, because it seems as if there's no space for them. But one of the beautiful things about, you know, Black women and the arts, and women of color in the arts, but I'll speak specifically to Black women, is that naturally I think that there's something in our DNA that makes us want to find space for everyone. When we allow ourselves to be our full selves, right? When we allow ourselves to be the full expression of our Black womanness, then we're naturally looking for spaces to be open and connect and be about community, because that's who we are. We are Nina. We are Angela. We are Zora. We're all of them, you know, all the time. And that's why I think that we could always look at these great women in history, you know, Dr. Maya Angelou and others. We look at them as mama, as mother, as whomever, mm-hmm. and not as these far off beings that we have no connection to, which is why I think when they pass on, when they become ancestors, when they transition, it hurts quite a bit deeper, because it's more about them being a part of your distant, possible my third cousin family, mm-hmm. and having a shared philosophy, even if it's in the subconscious, that hope of wanting to make this pool swell for all of us to be a part of. I think that that's in our nature. And so I think that organizations and institutions ultimately at the end of the day are also looking at the fact that their funders are changing and their patrons are changing. Mm-hmm. And I promise you, I'm not going to cut you $5 or become a member of your institution at all if I don't see that there is someone that looks like me in a position of leadership. If you are not curating, if you are not adding programming if you are not creating intersections in different communities, if you are ignoring any part of my experience whatsoever, you are not getting a dollar out of me. And my kids will be brought up not to give you money until that changes. And so I think that institutions that for a long time, educational institutions as well, which is why you have these Ivy League schools starting to divest from investing in the prison industrial complex, it's not because they care so much, it's because their funders are changing. Mm-hmm. And if your funders start to say, if your patrons start to say, the patrons who are us now, we are the patrons now, if we start to say that we want to see this type of programming in this organization or in this institution going forward, this is what would make me feel good about telling my friends more about this organization or lending my expertise to your board. You know, don't just jump on the board because, you know, it's a good brand. Jump on the board and find out if it's a place where you can actually have a voice. And, I think that because more of the funders are starting to look like, are starting to diversify by default, the programming and them looking at places of pre-existing value within communities, particularly Black women, mm-hmm. It's not just that difference as spectacle. It's now that is we're again commodified, but in a different way. It's commodified in a space that is just really an area of value and creating more balance to the people that are supporting them.
I want to quickly get into the high water picks and also Janice's picks.
I get to pick something.
You get to pick.
You know we like to have choices.
Yes. Options. So
lemonade.
I like to Man, I really had a thought that because of the time frame we're in right now, anyone who listen to the first 7 episodes of this podcast is going to think I only know about Beyonce and Prince. But to be fair, if you only know Beyonce and Prince,
You got a lot covered. Listen.
But I do listen to other things and other artists. And 2 of them actually put out albums last week,
today?
Yes.
Oh, that was so good.
The homie K Trinada, and I call him the homie, not because I know him.
Homie too.
Yes, he is the homie. I want to be friends with this dude. Like, you know,
he's our homie. He's our homie.
We're claiming it.
Yes.
So, K Trinada, if you're listening to this, we know you.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we really dig the first full-length LP you just put out called 99%.
It's
awesome. You found Craig David.
Listen.
You pulled Craig David out of the gym and you put him in the studio.
And you made him sing. And you made him sing.
We know, yes. Don't worry about the tag. Go and throw it in the bag, cause I got it good. You're the best I ever had, baby. You know that you're bad and I got it good. I'm certain.
Yeah, I was asking someone last night. I was like, listen, where's Craig David? Look, in the lab.
And I said, like, I don't know if y'all have seen Craig David lately, but he looks like he's doing that Dave Chappelle program where, like, he's not one of the ones you thought would be Brolic one day, but he is, like, Brolic.
He looks like Boudin.
Like, he's straight, and I think our producer, James, if I'm not mistaken, are you Googling a picture of Craig? He's looking it up to verify. You found Craig David. You have Sid the Kid from Odd Future on there. You have my homie Fonte from Foreign Exchange on there. You have Chicago's own Vic Mensa on there, and it's verified. I can tell from the look on James's face. So
facts.
Yes, facts only. But Kaytranada 99%. It is now on iTunes for sure, hopefully on some other outlets soon. And I would actually get the CD of this because the cover's really dope too. Also released in the last week is Anna Wise. So we're talking about this whole interest in all things feminine in pop culture. She just put out an album called The Feminine Act One, which is dope. You may have been first introduced to Anna Wise for her work with Kendrick Lamar. She's the female voice singing on If These Walls Can Talk. On Money Trees. The woman singing on Money Trees is just one of my favorite tracks. And so she just put out an album this week that is incredibly, incredibly dope. And then also in the theaters, you have Captain America. Civil War. It's interesting that it's called Civil War, and it's the Marvel movie with three black superheroes in it. Civil War. All this stuff is coded, yo. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you don't know that by now, but all this stuff is coded.
But listen, they definitely, one of the things I will say, and I think OK Africa did an article on this today, is that they definitely did not play the African characters like they like you have seen in movies in the past. Mm-hmm. No, they let them be everything that they were supposed to be and are, and they're absolutely fabulous and got decent time, mm-hmm. you know, and everything. And his bodyguard, though.
Like, can we talk about Sis that was, like, walking him to the car, though?
Yes, and that it was a woman, and she was bald, and she was fabulous, and she was, like, Lupita's cousin, but not because she could probably, like, beat up Lupita's cousin.
Yeah,
and
she looked a little bit like a little bit of Denai. Is a girl, you know, my homie Michonne from Walking Dead.
Yeah, something like that. We got a lot of friends.
Yeah, we know you all. Mm-hmm. And then also, can we talk about Spider-Man finally being what Spider-Man should have always been?
Some punk, ridiculous kid.
Yes.
I was happy to see Peter Parker look like an actual teenager.
Yes.
And be kind of dorky and funny at the same time and almost unrecognizable but still powerful. I was like, this is the Peter Parker we needed.
Absolutely. I could take that so many places, but I'm going to take it over to you. What are your picks, Janice?
Well, you know, what am I supposed to, just music, or is it doesn't
anything
matter?
Anything that think people need to know about.
Okay, so one, I would say that I recently just listened to a playlist that Sean Alvarez made for me, like maybe 2 years ago, like We Love Soul. And one of the things that I haven't done recently, but I used to do more regularly, is ask or pay my DJ friends or producer friends to make a mixtape for me. Because I still miss those, like those playlists and like mixtapes and things like that. Like I still rock with those. And so, these musicians, these artists, these producers, I mean, they're libraries, man, you know. And I remember just being like, man, look, will you make me a playlist, dude? Like, just, I really, really want one from you. And, you know, the thing is like, shoot, you know, they'll pay them for it. If they got time, you know, maybe they'll do it for you. So I just I've been listening to that real heavy, and it's mine, and you can't have it. So I guess I can't tell you
record
online.
So it's an exclusive. Like, this is some, like, textbook Janice Bond stuff.
It's
like,
mine, and
like,
I
I'm
love
like,
it.
Look, I have never thought, in all the DJs I know, I have never thought to just go up to one of my DJ friends and say, look, here's a dub, put some of just what you're listening to right now.
Well, it's called looking at DJs and selectors like visual artists and like other artists.
Hello.
It's called commissioning.
Hello.
You commission them to make you a playlist. You commission them to make you a mixtape, whatever. So I've been listening to that, and that's been great. I guess I'm going to have to find something more public to talk about. One other thing I've been listening to over and over again is another thing that a track that I got from an artist, producer, sound alchemist, Val Jainty out of Brooklyn. She has this track that she created with Alsara of Alsara and Anubatones. She's a Sudanese pop artist, and so I was listening to that quite a bit. But I've been going a little bit backwards lately to my old trusties because I can't listen. I'm in a different type of rotation when I listen to new music. Mm-hmm. Like I have to do it when my mind is a little bit clearer. And right now I'm in like work grind mode. Mm-hmm. So I had to go back to an old faithful besides my playlist. And that's always Estero. And
oh my God, yes.
Girl, you know I love Estero.
Oh my gosh.
Breath from Another. Hey, boo.
We know her too. Janice actually does, but so
Breath from Another, dude. Breath from Another is like one of my favorite albums. I want to say it came out in 98.
It did.
Yeah, it came out in 98. And it was around that time that whole movement was happening with like trip hop and jungle and, you know, Goldie was doing his thing and Tricky was doing his thing and Bjork was doing her thing and like just everything was just lovely. And, you know, the one thing I like about that 99% and a couple of other albums that are coming out right now is that you start to get that vibe, you know, you're starting to get that connection again between hip-hop music and trip-hop. And, like, for example, you know, Estero's World I Know, the remix that featured Goody Mob, you know, how luscious was that? How great was when she did the track with Left Eye? You know, that was
you're
awesome.
Putting me on. You know, I've never heard this Estero Left Eye track.
Yeah, she had a track with Left Eye. And there are other artists, you know, that were in that same vein, that, you know, Portishead and others, that have done some
Thievery
really
Incorporated.
Great. Listen, Thievery Corporation really, you know, over and over again. And that's where those like mixtapes started to come about, like was it Stephanie Pomponet? Like that was when he started doing the Hotel, Hotel Coast or something like that. And so we had those, 22, I think, maybe less, but like, I think it was like 22 mixtapes that he produced out of a hotel, if I'm DJing in a lobby in Paris. And I mean, there's just a lot of that. So one album that I will say that is completely public and available is 100 by DJ Sun, Rep Houston. One of my favorite instrumental albums that's out there, and it has some vocals from a couple of featured artists, but 100 is banging. It's always been banging. It's been out. If you haven't heard it yet, you're late, but it's still dope. DJ Sun out of Houston, Rep.
Well, I'm happy to be late. I'm learning all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, better late than never. I would say also, you know, take a look at what's happening hyper-locally, what's going on with Norman Teague and, you know, all of the stuff that he's doing. They just had the MFA show, Sadie Woods and her music boxes and where she's going with that. She's definitely an artist, both in sound and other sculptures, so forth and so on, that I really see. You know, as she's in the lab and disappears until it's time to show some stuff these days, but I'm always willing and ready to see what she's, you know, about to put out. And this month, I'll just stop there a little bit because I have some stuff that's coming up for me, but I'll save that for, you know, stay tuned for all that good stuff.
Maybe for the show notes?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Janice Bond, International Woman of Art, Mystery, and Intrigue, for coming on our show today.
Oh my gosh, this was wonderful.
It was amazing. So we hope that you got a whole lot out of this particular episode, listeners, because we talk a lot about the creative process and we talk a little bit about having sustainable careers as creatives, but it's not too often that we have perspective for someone that has been able to navigate both worlds and both sides of the coin, and we do mean coin. So so we always want to take the entrepreneurial spin on being artists and being creatives whenever we can. So before we leave, I want to remind you that the best way to complain is to make stuff. So get back to work.
And as my daddy always saying, nothing to it but to do it.
Nothing to it but to do it. And as one of my uncles always said, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. You've been listening to the High Water Podcast, a production of Post Loudness, a collective of independent audio shows produced by people of color, women, and queer-identified hosts. You can learn more at postloudness.com.